work on it. And they went, no, 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 I'm not going to work on anything filthy. But one of the guys that I got to know a bit, his name was Virgil Ross. I got to know him when he was in his late 80s. And he was, an exceptional animator. And he was a guy who quite willingly went and worked on Fritz the Cat and so on. And I don't know, are you familiar with the film, Bob?
I saw Fritz the Cat, yes, in Halifax.
Do you remember there's scenes with these two, there's some policemen who are pigs, literally, they're pigs?
Yeah.
Well, Virgil did almost all of those, all of that sequence of those policemen as pigs.
Right.
And it's just brilliant stuff. I mean, it's amazing animation. And Bakshi himself noted how great it was and gave credit to Virgil Ross and so on in certain interviews later on. And
it's
amazing.
He lived to be 1907.
Virgil?
Yeah, to 96. He's American artist, cartoonist, and animator, best known for his work in the Warner Brothers animated shorts.
Yeah.
And the guy, you gave us a recording of Yosemite Sam. He did a lot of work on that cartoon.
Absolutely. He would have worked on almost every Yosemite Sam cartoon of the ever made. In the Warner Brothers period.
They don't mention Ralph Bakshi in his life.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, he did a lot of, especially, I don't know whether, how much he did after Fritz the Cat, but I know he did a lot of animation on Fritz the Cat. Quite a lot of footage, like minutes of film, which is, for an animator, is a considerable amount to do on any animated feature, to do multiple minutes.
He's wearing very thick glasses, and he's smiling nicely.
Who, Virgil?
Yeah.
He was the sweetest man. I mean, he was just, he was...
You met him?
Oh, yeah, I've been at his house, I knew his wife, and yeah, I made a point of wanting to, of meeting him. I mean, of...
Did you already say that? Did you already say
what?
You met him?
Yeah, I did, yeah,
oh,
yeah, I met him on multiple occasions, and he was really the sweetest man, his wife, wonderful person, just really great people. I can't say enough about him, and a really brilliant animator, just when I see his work, it's just perfect. I mean, the stuff
right.
he did. And interestingly, he felt belittled. He worked for a director, Friz Freleng, and he, when I talked to him about his work, he would say, "Well, I didn't have a good feeling about myself. Bob Clampett didn't like my stuff, and Friz Freleng always liked some other animator better than me, and he just felt like he was insignificant, and so it was very difficult, when you're telling him how great he is, it's he's bewildered by it, he couldn't accept it, and yet he'd worked from early 1930s all the way through into the 90s. I mean, he was still animating into the 90s. I mean, not far off when he died.
Well, how do you spell Freleng?
He was still working.
I don't see. I don't see. How do you spell Freleng? I don't see that in his.
F R E L E N G.
L E N G.
Yeah.
E N G. There it is. So we spent about 30 years at Warner Brothers under Tex Avery. Did you meet Tex Avery?
I did.
Yeah. Then for Bob Clampett, and finally with Fritz Freleng. So he worked with the guy, and yet he felt he wasn't appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, he was with he he was he was with Avery. Tex Avery was really Tex Avery's top animator at Warner Brothers, and then Tex Avery left to go to MGM, and Virgil could have gone and gone over to MGM and probably made more money, but he didn't leave. He decided to stay at Warner Brothers. He told me, he says, you know, all through the years that I was at Warner Brothers, you know, even in the 1930s, they'd always be telling us that it wasn't going to last very long because they said, you know, we don't make any money on these things. We're just doing them for the kids. And so, you know, there'll be a point where, you know, they just won't do them. And he said this went on for years and years and years and years, decades, where they'd be told, you know, it's all going to be over soon.
And this justified,
you know,
they'd
all
be
out of work. What?
This justified their low salaries?
I think I don't know how much he... I know who made the most money there as an animator, because I met him and I worked with him. His name was Ken Harris. He was considered to be the top animator at Warner Brothers, and he was the one that somehow managed to, you know, make the most money there. And everybody, you know, like, basically, they'd walk... This is how it worked. If you weren't Ken Harris, you'd walk into the room asking for a raise, and the producer of the studio would say, "Oh, you want a raise, do you? Are you as good as Ken Harris?" And they'd go, "Well, no." They go, "Well, how do you? Well, when you become as good as Ken Harris, then you can have a raise."
But wait, if they said they were shutting down any day, did that have?
Yeah.
Did they get not much money?
Well, I think an animator at Warner Brothers would have made, you know, pretty good money compared to most people. You know,
but they had a sense of this is just for kids and not art or anything. It was going to end.
And in fact, when Warner Brothers, the cartoon studio, shut down for a period of time in 1953, and there are lots of stories about why it shut down, and there's stories that Jack Warner did a test to see whether they could make 3D cartoons, and they made it. They actually made a 3D Bugs Bunny, and he determined that it was either too costly or it didn't work or whatever, and he felt that the future of movies was going to be 3D. And so the story is that he shut the cartoon department down. And then when 3D failed, he started it back up again. The other story is that they had a big backlog of movies. They had a big backlog of cartoons, and they were just working through the backlog, and they just laid everybody off for about a year.
Right.
So they had every intention of starting the studio up again and doing it. But I heard that Virgil left. You know, he got laid off in 1953 at the Warner Brothers cartoon department, and he decided, "Oh, screw it! I'm going to do what I really want to do, and I'm going to become a pianist." And he was very musical, and he went off and became made his living as a piano player. And had no intention of going back into the cartoon business. He was going to, because that's what that's what he felt was his real talent, was music and so on. And so they reformed the cartoon studio, and Fritz Freleng, you know, brought back his animators, and you can see this in the films made after 1953 or 54, it takes a few cartoons to get Virgil Ross back.
Mm.
Because he's off playing piano in some lounge or something. That's where he's making his money, living.
Right. Did you interview all these guys you met? Did you find out about the history of the whole industry in detail from these different people? Is that what you would ask them?
Well, I wished I'd been more equipped to do interviews, but I didn't. You know, I didn't have the equipment. I'd often be down in California, you know, it wasn't so easy to just, you know, find equipment at that time.
Yeah.
To do an interview. Mike Barrier, on the other hand, the guy I talked about who was the publisher of this Funny World magazine, he did make great efforts in the late 1960s and through the 70s to go and interview as many people as possible, and retains tape recorded records of interviews with people, and it was at a time when he'd be arranging to do interviews and people would die before he could get there.
Mm.
Because they were all getting pretty elderly, and in most cases, what he did are the only records of any interviews done with a lot of these people who have subsequently become, you know, of interest to people.
Yeah.
And many of his interviews have never been transcribed. He's never, you know, there's been, he does them himself. He'll go and do a transcript, and sometimes he'll publish them on his website, MikeBarrier.com, I think it's called, or MichaelBarrier.com.
Why do you say they weren't transcribed? He did it.
He would do them, yes, but he can only do, you know, he only has time to do and energy to do so many, so he sort of cherry picks through what the material that he has and decides, oh, I'll do that, you know, whatever interests him. But evidently, he's got, you know, tons and tons of stuff that will probably never see the light of day, or maybe it'll see the light of day after he dies. Maybe he'll, you know, give them to a university or something. But he did a lot of the interviews. But yeah, I would meet them, you know, like Virgil Ross. I'd talk to him about things, but by that point, they forget things, you know, like we all do, like you don't, you'd have a hard time relating to this.
Yes.
But they forget things and basically, I remember I would go over to his house.
And where was this?
In Hollywood. It was off Cahuenga Boulevard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you would do this,
is this the 90s or the 70s?
Yeah, in the 90s. Yeah, his house was up in the Hollywood Hills off Cahuenga Boulevard, and I'd right near Hanna-Barbera, where Hanna-Barbera used to be.
Yes.
And so you'd go up this big, big, big hill, and he'd have a house there, and his driveway would be on an incredibly steep incline, and he had this huge, you know, old car, and you know, I can't, you know, and of course it's got to have the brakes on it, or else it would, you know, if the brakes ever failed on it, they would go careening,
yeah,
you know, down the Hollywood Hills, and I'd go up to his house, and I remember going there, and I knew that Bugs Bunny, the Bugs Bunny show, was going to be on the television. So I said, hey, Virgil, why don't we watch Bugs Bunny? And he goes, okay. So we'd sit there and we'd be watching it. And not every cartoon would come on that he would have had something to do with, but I distinctly remember seeing one that he did have something to do with. And I'd be watching it, and I go, oh, you did that part. And that's yours. That's your work here. And he'd be sitting there, and he goes, I wouldn't know. And I go, really? I said, you can't tell you did that? He goes, no, I wouldn't know.
Wow.
And I go, well, but I said, your stuff is so identifiable, you know? He was just startled, I think, that I would know what he did. And he goes, well, all right, if you say I did that, I guess I did it. And he would have done, you know, in any one cartoon at that period. It was, I remember it was a late 1950s cartoon, and there were only three animators on it. And I'd be calling out all of them. I'd say, oh, that's Art Davis, that's Jerry Shinicky, that's you. That's... I'd be calling out everybody who's animating on it. And he'd go, oh, yeah, okay. And actually, it was an interesting... I don't know whether it was interesting
or not. Someone should have videotaped you two interacting. You're telling
Disney.
Yeah,
I know, it would have been funny. It would have been funny.
Yeah.
He actually... A bit of a controversy occurred. There was this guy, his name was Steve Schneider, and I met him in the early 1980s through a teenage guy that I knew who lived in New York, who was really interested in jazz and also in the early 1930s cartoons. And he was... and he co-wrote a book about Warner Brothers cartoons, and he took on the earlier cartoons in this book to write about because he was so interested in jazz, because jazz figured so much in the 1930s Warner Brothers cartoons, the Merry Melodies and the Looney Tunes and so on. And so I went to New York, and I met him. I just communicated with him through the mails. And I guess he was about 19 years old at the time. And his name was Will Friedwald. And he said to me, he says, hey, so I'm in New York with Mary, and we might have been there with somebody else, and we're meeting up with people in New York and doing things there. And he says to me, hey, Greg, he phones me up at the hotel. He says, hey, Greg, you want to go and see a whole lot of Warner Brothers artwork, cartoon artwork? And I go, yeah, of course. He goes, okay. He says, meet me. I'll come over to the hotel, and we'll leave, and I'll take you there. I go, okay. So we go off, and we go on a train to Long Island. And we arrive at this, what seemed to me a very residential, sort of, you know, maybe well-to-do area, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he leads me to this house, and we walk in, and he introduces me to this guy, Steve Schneider. And it's, you know, there's a piano in the living room and so on. He takes us down into the basement, and he puts on, you know, rubber gloves or something, or... And he starts filing, in a different room, he starts filing through all this artwork, and he brings it out piece by piece. And he starts sort of quizzing me about, like, what it is. And so I look at it, and I go, oh, well, that's from, and I go, well, that's from, he brings out a piece of artwork. And I go, well, that's from this cartoon, 1942 or whatever, right?
You knew all that?
And he goes, what?
You knew that?
Oh, yeah. And he brings it out, and he tries to trick me on things, and sometimes he did trick me. He showed me things. He says, what's this? And I go, gee, I don't know what that is. And it was a background for a famous cartoon, but it was part of a background, and the rest of the background kind of covered up the background, and so I didn't recognize it. But for the most part, I knew everything that he brought out. I knew what cartoon it was, but here's the thing. He kept bringing out things, and I go, this must be done by the animator John Carey. Well, his face just blanched out white when I said this. And then he shot this glare over to the guy who'd brought me, this 19-year-old kid. He glares over at him with, like, a vicious stare. And I noticed this, right? And so when we left, and he goes, and then he goes, how do you know that? And I go, well, I said, you know, well, it's this particular cartoon, and I know that he worked on it, and so on and so forth. But how do you know that? In particular, how do you know that? And I go, well, I said, it's just a guess, really. He says, no, this isn't a guess. How do you know this? And he got really militant with me, right? And I didn't know what to say to him. I kind of knew who did it. And so we leave, and I say to this, you know, the kid that had brought me there, I go, what was that all about? Like, why did he get so angry with me? And he goes, oh, well, he thought that I told you how he got the stuff. And I said, he says, but you didn't, did you? He says, no, I didn't. He says, well, what he does is he read the obituaries from Hollywood. And if he read that some animator had died, he'd get on a plane and fly out there and shake the widow down for the artwork.
Yeah.
And that's how he got the stuff. So basically, John Kerry died. He flew out immediately and shook her down for everything she had.
Would he pay her
for nothing,
a bit?
Right? What?
He'd pay her for it.
He tried not to pay anybody anything. He shook Virgil down. He went out to Virgil, and Virgil was, like, most of my time going over to see Virgil was to try to protect him from these sharks, because he was so nice, you know. He'd give stuff away, and then they'd go off and sell it all. And what the Schneider guy did, he went out to Virgil, and he says, you know, your stuff deserves to be in a museum. You know, this is very historically important material. You know, the artwork that you've kept, it's very rare, and it deserves to be in a museum. And if you give it to me, then I will make sure that it goes in a museum. And they just, a lot of these guys would just give him the stuff.
Right. And he'd sell it to the museum?
What he would do is he'd basically bank all this stuff up. And he had some foresight, this guy, because when he was picking all this stuff up in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, it really wasn't worth anything. You could pick up this material on the open market for, you know, he could get drawings for $5 and stuff like that. But by the late 80s, I mean, this stuff, every drawing was going for $500. So basically all of this material that he had obtained by flying out there and shaking people down, at least in part, and sort of telling them that he was going to do wonderful things with their work if only he gave everything to them. And these, you know, he's talking to people who were in their 80s,
yeah,
70s and 80s, and they're kind of going, you know, and some of them had no children. Virgil had no children. Virgil and his wife had no children. I knew another couple who worked with Virgil, very, very wonderful people, Holly Pratt and so on. Steve Schneider had gone out there and got the artwork from them. And,
did he sell it to somebody?
What he would do is he'd barter it, you know. He'd start using material and barter. He tried to barter stuff with me. He found out that I had some stuff that he wanted. And I remember we got into a negotiation about it. And he wouldn't want to give you anything important. He'd start sending you stuff that, you know, was... He kind of knew what you want, what you liked, or the kind of people you were looking for. And then he'd send you stuff that was of, you know, not very great importance. And I'd say, oh, I want one of these type things. And he'd go, oh, no, I can't do that. You know, and so but anyway, what happened was Steve Schneider had all this Virgil Ross stuff. And he put out a book called That's Not All, Folks, which was, you know, he put out a book with all this artwork in it and commentary about Warner Brothers cartoons. This would have been about 1986, 1987, something. And I got an advance copy of it, or some promotional material. And in it, there's this, some artwork and of Bugs Bunny doing a tap dance from a cartoon. And it says, oh, this is animated by Virgil Ross. And I go, That was never done by him. So I get in touch. I phone up Steve Schneider. I have a phone number for him. And I phone out and go, hey, Steve, you got to do something about this. That's not Virgil Ross's stuff at all. And he goes, yeah, but I got it from Virgil. I go, yeah, you might have got it from Virgil, but he didn't do it. And because I knew, like later on I learned, Virgil didn't even know what he did. Now, most of the stuff that Virgil had in his, you know, that he maintained for some reason, some of the drawings from the cartoons and full flippable animation, like full scenes of animation. Some of the stuff, most of it was his. Most 99% of it was work that Virgil had done, but this one scene was not, and it was unclear. He'd totally forgotten why he had it. I kind of know why he had it, I think. I mean, it lost to the ages exactly why, but I could guess why he had it. But I'd worked with the guy who'd actually done it, and it's quite a famous piece of animation. And so I said to Steve Schneider, I said, you know, you should change that. He said, oh, well, it's already gone to press. I said, well, I said, if it goes for another edition, you should alter that, because, I mean, Virgil never did it. You know, with all due respect to Virgil, he didn't animate this thing.
Okay, and, great. I got a question. How did you, did you watch these cartoons over and over again through the years? That's how.
Yeah, of course I did. Well, they ran them over and over again.
When? Saturday morning?
They ran them over and over again on, I mean, I'd watch them on, Bugs Bunny show was on at night in the early 60s. It was a nighttime ABC television program. So I started watching them there, and then they'd be on during the day. You know, different ones would be on during the day, and then they'd be on Canadian television. The Bugs Bunny show would run on the CBC, and then they started syndicating a whole bunch. I mean, they were on television all the time.
And there was a limited number of them.
There were, in total, and these wouldn't have all been in certainly not distributed at the same time, but between 1931 and 1969, when they stopped making them, they made about 1,100.
Hmm.
So now, at any given time, you know, when I say they made 1,100, in reality, there might have only been about 500 or 600 in distributed,
yeah,
on a consistent basis, and even that, I would say even lower numbers than that. So you would see the same, you tend to see the same ones often. So you could, if you liked them, you could really appreciate them.
And you'd keep watching this into your 20s and 30s.
Oh yeah. Well, I become more. I mean, actually, I become more and more interested in it. I mean, the thing is, when you see them as a kid, you see them one way, but when you see them when you're older, you're seeing them, it's like it's fresh. And then I became an animator, and you start, and a producer of animation, and you start seeing these things, and they seem even more amazing than they ever did. You go, because you're trying to do stuff that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going, and, you're having a hard time getting anywhere near the quality that they've achieved, 40 years before. So not only the quality of the animation and the backgrounds and the layouts and the music and the writing and the everything. It's just, these were top-notch cartoons. Because
You were watching it as part of your own profession and trade. You would try to pick up from what they did. You try to see their new techniques or discover.
Yeah, I mean, and also I was, personally, I would say even personally, I was trying to be as good as I thought they were. I was trying to emulate and do. Like, I look at some of my stuff that I did when I was, in my mid-20s, and, television commercials, and I look at them and I go, oh, I'm trying to do, know, I can see what my influences are. I can see who I'm trying to do, you know, with the poses and the way it's drawn and everything. I can go, oh, I'm trying to emulate that animator, you know?
Right.
Or I'm trying to do what they did. And so
how many did you make in Toronto in the 80s when you had a business?
What? How many commercials?
Commercials, animated, the animated part.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I mean, probably not as many as I.
100? Like what's a?
I would think that between 19, like I got back to Toronto in 1975, and I started. I was 19 years old, I guess, and I was doing, you know, I was animating commercials, you know, like top national commercials at 19 years old. So
for another company, not your company.
No, not my company. No, I was doing them. I was doing them as a most of them. I was doing as a freelancer. I got to be. Somehow people got to know that I had, I don't mean to blow my own horn, but, I mean, it got around that I had experience or that I knew something or other. I don't know. There were lots of other animators, but they weren't doing the commercials. I was doing the commercials. And it was the commercials that were the most money.
Now, did you, what kind of salary, let's say by the time you're 25, what is the salary you're making? Total in a year.
Well, I kind of, well, you know, pardon me. I was working freelance. So let me think back. If I was doing a commercial, well, I'd want to make at least $500 a week. I know that. For a commercial, I'd want to make about, you know, like to animate and do all the drawings for a 30-second commercial, I think I'd want to make somewhere around a couple thousand dollars. I think. I'd spend three weeks to a month, perhaps, doing commercials. I'd make about $500 a week, which I think, you know, was not bad at the time for a 19-year-old in the mid-70s. And when I worked in Cleveland, I made $400 U.S. a week. And I worked for a large corporation called Penton Publishing, Penton IPC, and they published trade magazines, and it was just fluky. They had this little animation department. It was just total fluke. I mean, it wasn't even part of their business. They did it because the president was something. You know, I won't even go into it, but it was just fluky, and so. I was one of two animators at this little tiny division within this large corporation. And so they came to Toronto and were looking for an animator. And I found out later that the guy who ran the company, he says, oh, well, the reason we came to Toronto is because we'd heard that there were animators there, you know, the National Film Board and all that, that there were lots of good animators in Canada, so that's why we went there. And, which is a, you know, weird thing to do, but anyway, he did. And I remember going down, I took my 16mm film with me, my showreel, such as it was, of work. This would be 1976. Went down to a hotel, you know, down on Queen Street. Went up to this hotel room, and these, you know, guys from the United States were there. They had a projector. And they ran my showreel and interviewed me. And, you know, I walked out of there. I thought, well, you know, it's probably, you know, they've seen. I heard everybody was going down to this thing. Yeah. I'd come late to the game. I didn't even know that they put a want ad in the newspapers. It had gone around everybody in the animation community in Toronto, and I found out about it just by a fluke. And so I thought, well, the chances of getting this job are slim, but I live here. I just went down and did it. Anyway, they called me up and they said, "Okay, we picked you."
16 years old.
And I was 19.
19.
At the time. I was 19, or, yeah.
In 76,
was I?
Yeah. You were born in 56?
76. No, 55. Maybe I was 20. I was 20. At this point, I'm 20. I'm 20. And they phone up and say, "Okay, we've decided to hire you." And I go, "Well, okay." And they said, "No, we have to negotiate your salary. What do you want?" I said, "Well, I want $25,000 a year." And they go, whoa, what? And I go, so they negotiate, we negotiate to $20,000 a year. And I go, okay. And the reason that I asked for 25 was that my mother I'd wake up in the morning at home. I was living at home in Toronto, in Scarborough. And my mother'd be getting up at, 5 o'clock in the morning to prepare to go to work at her government job. And she just stormed into my bedroom one morning and says, "Young man, you're going, if you don't make $20,000 a year, you're going back to school. You're going back to school, young man." And, because I was working as a freelancer, I'd get a job and, sometimes I wouldn't have a job and I tried to make money. It was, at that time, I know this must be shocking to people, who are listening now or younger, but when you worked contract like that, when you worked freelancer, people paid you more. They paid you more than you would if you were salaried. Now, they pay you the same as if you had a salaried job, then there was sort of an understanding that you'd make a bit more money because you didn't have job security. And so my mother was just out of her mind that I was not living up to something or other. And so I thought, I got into the negotiations with these people. And I said, and I think I was working at the time and making about $400. I had a job. I was going down to work every day, and I had a job, and I was making $400 a week. So, which is about $20,000 a year. And so I thought, well, I better ask for more money because I've got to have some negotiating room. I'm surprised I actually had this sort of business acumen at the time. And so that's why I asked for 25, and it worked down to 20, and I go, okay. So I got this job, and then I said to my mother comes home, and I said, by the way, Mom, you know how you said that I needed to get a job that pays $20,000 a year? I said, well, I got one, but I'm moving to Cleveland, Ohio. And she just about freaked out. I mean, she didn't know what to say, She'd sort of lay down the gauntlet, and then I'd managed to actually, meet her demands.
Yes, yeah.
So she didn't know what to do about it, So, but anyway, that's how I ended up down there. But that would have been about what I was making. Then later on, I came back to Canada, and, the best you could negotiate. I remember I came back from the United States making $400 a week, U.S., which may or may not have been more money. I think it was, more, I think the Canadian dollar was lower. I think it was rising. Canadian dollar was rising against U.S. At that time. Anyway, I came back, and the best I could negotiate to work in Toronto was $325 a week.
Mm.
And but I was always trying to make about $20,000 a year.
Well, what about when you had a successful company?
What was I making?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a little difficult to say because I don't really remember. You know, we'd kind of get paid. Mary and I would get paid sort of intermittently or as we needed it, and or through, like, the accountant would decide how much money we'd make. Hmm. He'd say, well, this year you're going to take a salary of this amount and we're going to give you dividends of that amount.
Hmm.
So, but I mean, we did, there was a time where I think one would consider that we were doing really well, much to my surprise. You know, when we first started, it seemed to me that I was fronting the money to bankroll the company, to put the, you know, buy the stocks for the company. And I remember Mary and I were in a grocery store, an A&P grocery store in Scarborough, and I'm working out, like, how we can, much as it was her idea more than anything else, I should say, but I'm working out, well, how to finance this thing, right?
Yeah.
And I said, I've got $20,000 saved. I figure that we can last for about a year on that $20,000, and, you know, with the company. Because, I mean, the whole idea of going and borrowing money to start the company, I mean, that was just, I mean, maybe it should have been a consideration, but I never thought about that. I never thought about going into debt to do it.
Yeah.
And, which is, I guess, not a good idea. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. It worked for us, but, may, you know, who knows?
What did Mary do?
What did she work at?
Yeah. She worked with
you? She was in the animation business, too.
Ah.
She was working in animation in Toronto in the mid-70s, I guess. But I came to visit the studio that she was working at. Because I knew somebody there. I was working in Cleveland, and I came to the studio and got a tour in Toronto. While I was working in Cleveland, I was toured around this studio called Nelvana, which eventually became a big place in Toronto. And she claims that she remembers seeing me there, you know, or mm-hmm. noticing me, or, you know, like being impressed by seeing me when I walked into this, was introduced or something,
yeah.
You know? And we met almost as soon as I got back from Cleveland. I met her because the guy that I used to do commercials for when I was 19 years old, he got in touch with me and wanted me to work on another commercial that he was doing. So I came back to Toronto and I was immediately working again. I had lots of work. I was working on multiple jobs at the same time. I'd wake up at, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning and I'd work all the way through to about 10 at night. You know, I'd have a nap in the afternoon and I'd do two shifts every day of working on this stuff. And,
you work at home?
I worked at home, yeah. I did all of it at home.
And that was in Scarborough?
Yeah, I did all of it at home.
So what would you do with your money? Since you were, for a young guy, you were making pretty good. What did you do in leisure activities?
Well, I would make sure that I would say, you know, I was very keen to save money. You know, I'd always put away money. I'd put away, out of every paycheck, I'd make sure I put away some. I remember when I was in Cleveland, I remember the biggest thing that I did that involved money, I would say, would be either flying home to see my parents once every so often, or flying up to Chicago to meet with a guy that I'd worked with in animation in Paris, who happened to be back in the United States and working in Chicago.
Hmm.
So I guess that was the main thing I did. When I came back to Toronto, I don't remember really being, you know, spending a lot of money on anything. I mean, I might. No, I don't. I don't remember. You know, I just banked up the money. That was. I was living at home, and
you could save a lot.
Yeah, I'd try. You know, I put away money and made sure I had some money for whatever. You know.
Did you have to pay rent to your parents?
I think at some point they said, yeah, they suggested that I pay some money. Yeah, I think so. I paid. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
How old were you when you got together with Mary?
I was 20. I was 21 or 22.
So you were with her over 20 years?
Yeah.
30 years?
20. Well, I mean, we were divorced in 2002. So we started living together in March 1978.
That's 34 years.
So 24 years.
34. Yeah. 34.
24.
Oh, no, that's 28. That's 78. That's into 1980.
24
right.
years, yeah.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. I mean, not as long as you've been with Carolyn, but certainly. But the, but yeah, we. I remember getting back to that AMP story. I remember we're in the AMP story. I'm going, you know, I think we can. You know, I was prepared to go through the $20,000, but you know, if something wasn't happening within a year, I was going, well, you know, we won't have anything, you know. Well, that's the risk.
Yeah.
That's the gamble. And then we'll just have to go back to work and, you know, make money as usual if we can't get it to work. That was a very, I mean, I realize now, and maybe I did even then eventually, that it was a naive idea that I could do that, you know. It cost a lot more money, and there were a lot more complications, but we, but it sort of worked out, you know. Things came together, and we and probably, you know, a lot quicker than, you know, when I look back on it, it's probably amazing that it came together as quickly as it did, and that we were able to, you know, make a living at it as a company. And because there are a lot of barriers, you know, like the advertising agencies. There's a lot of graft in the advertising business, a lot of having to pay, you know, do favors for people and paying money. And I never thought about doing that. I would never do that. I'm just not, I just don't believe in it. But I think that's a very North American, you know, bribery and that kind of thing, I think, is quite rampant. But I can't operate that way. I mean, I'm very straightforward. I feel that I'm doing a service or a work or whatever, and I'm charging what I think it's worth, and I'm paid that, and that should be enough. And I remember one commercial we worked on. I learned something about the business. I knew certain people in the advertising business because I'd worked doing commercials for other people. And so occasionally I'd meet people and I had some knowledge of them, and not very many, but a few. And I remember going to visit somebody at an advertising agency with what I'd had something to do with, and telling them that we'd started this company and showed them the work that we'd done and so on. And we ended up doing this commercial. Or he said to us, he said, well, look, we've got this commercial from England for Crest toothpaste. And I knew who did it. I knew the people personally who had done it. I knew the studio. I knew their method of working and all of that. And they showed me this commercial from England. And it was sort of, you know, a little bit involved in a way. You know, I mean, I knew how they did it. I looked at it. I go, I know how they did this. And it involved live action and animation, but I knew exactly how they produced it. And so he said to me, well, Procter & Gamble, they don't know whether anybody here can make this commercial. So, but they want to do a Canadian version. So it needs to be proven to them that someone can do it. And he says, well, do you think you can do this? And I go, yeah. He says, well, what we'd like to see a 5-second version of this commercial. 5 seconds only. You know, or a few seconds, just to prove that it can be done. So I said, okay. So we leave the place, and they're not going to pay us any money. So we walk out with Mary, and we're talking about it. And I said, okay, Mary, we're going to make the entire commercial, the full commercial, the full. It was a 60-second commercial, I believe. I said, we're going to make that whole thing. We're not just going to do a test of 5 seconds. We're going to make the whole damn thing. And she goes, what? And I go, yeah, we're going to do the whole thing. We're going to make it all. And she goes, well, why would you do that? They only want 5 seconds. I said, yeah. But I said, 5 seconds isn't enough to show somebody. They'll look at it and they'll look at it and they won't know. And I said, I think we can do this in the period of time we've got is for this little test. We've got nothing else to do. There's no other work in the studio. And I know how to make this thing. And I said, I think we can do it. It won't cost us very much to make it. And I think, you know, we can, if we, I said, they're just going to be blown away when they see the entire thing done. So.
And you wouldn't get paid. You knew that.
I knew we weren't going to get paid. It was totally a test, but we knew they were, if we could prove that they were going to, that we could do this thing of the level of quality that they got from this English commercial. If we could replicate that, we were told we were going to get this commercial. So we go back to the studio, and at this point I've got my own camera, my own animation camera. We've got all the equipment to do it, right? Because I've somehow over the years I've collected all this stuff to do it. It looks pretty ramshackle, but I've got it. And so we go back and we make this thing. And we bring in Mary's, we even produce the soundtrack. We bring in Mary's niece, who's about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old. Take her in, and she just clams right up in the recording studio. And I eventually sent Mary in. I said, you do it. You do the little girl's voice. I said, and we'll speed you up so you sound like a little girl. Not that she didn't sound like a little girl a bit already, but speeding it up helped. So we made this whole commercial for Crest toothpaste, and it involved, what it involved, the live action angle of it, involved a hand. A hand would come in and interact, like a live action hand would come in and interact with the cartoon character. And I knew that how they did it by examining the film, they shot it with a real hand over top of the real artwork on an animation camera. So I used my hand, and I animated frame by frame, interacting with animation drawings that were put in, you know, right there. So we shot the whole thing in one go. We didn't do any fancy optical work or compositing or anything. We just shot it all, like, frame by frame with a hand in there animating. So I was actually animating my hand frame by frame. I was like, I was, I, we, we, my arm was put into a contraption. We built a little contraption that would lock my arm in position. It was very painful to go through hours and hours and hours of shooting locked into a contraption. And we had to put a magnifying glass under the camera and light it properly. And we brought in a guy, I mean, we actually must have spent some money doing this. We brought in a photographer friend of ours who lit the entire set of the animation so that, because this magnifying glass had to come in, being held by a hand. And anyway, it was a bit of work. But we you know, it was a good first step to do to we got through a lot of the hurdles. If Procter & Gamble had said, oh, no, it looks terrible, well, we wouldn't have done it. But I knew damn well it was going to look great. And I knew they'd be impressed because the whole thing would be there. It was like the whole thing was finished.
Yeah.
And, but, like, we were just going to present it, like, oh, well, this is a rough version of what it would be. And then that's what happened. We finished the whole thing off. And the guy, the advertising agency guy we showed it to, I mean, he was just... He just smiled from ear to ear. I mean, he couldn't believe it. And he says, "Oh, this is amazing!" and then he took it to the Procter & Gamble, and they went, "Oh, this is great. Let's go ahead." So then we went in, and we had to negotiate what we were going to charge for this thing. So we said, "Well, this is what we charge for a commercial." And he goes, he looks at us, and he goes, yeah, but he says, have you factored in for a makeup artist for the hand? And we go, well, no, we haven't. He says, add in some money there. And then we go, he goes, and have you, and he starts telling us, that whatever we presented as the budget is just way too low.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we got up to 90, he got us up to $90,000. We'd started around 30. He'd got us up to 90. And we're going, oh, okay. because here's the thing. What he knew and we didn't know is that at the time, is that when you're doing a commercial, let's say for Canada or the United States or whatever, and it's a national commercial, it's going to be run coast to coast, they're having a big air buy, they're going to be spending tons of money on the thing, it determines what the budget is. So you're getting about, if they're going to spend $1 million on the air, they're going to spend $100,000 to make the commercial. If it's a local air buy, and the commercial could be just as complicated or more complicated or involve more costs from our perspective, being producers, if it's a local, like, or a regional commercial or retail commercial, and the air buy is very small, the budget will be a lot smaller. And, they could come to you and ask you to do amazing things or, demand a lot. So it's when you do this advertising commercials, the advertising agency almost has to go in and charge a lot of money, say that the production company wants a lot of money, because the advertising agency tacks on another 17% at least on top of your cost. They know they're going to be spending $1 million on the air. Well, that means they're tacking 17% onto all the airtime they're buying. So there's $170,000 extra on $1 million air buy, and then they're tacking on another, $17,000 onto whatever you're charging, and all the other costs that are involved in making the commercial, other suppliers that are involved, sound and all of that. So that's why they, this guy's telling us, well, you got to charge more money. So, this was in, I believe this happened in the first year of us running the company. So this was a big moneymaker for us, this commercial. It,
right.
it made it so that we could pay the rent for quite a few weeks if we didn't have any work. But it was hard to get. The advertising agencies were beholden to certain people. There was like a mafia involved in it. And when you would get involved in it, it meant that you were, you know, horning in on the money, you know, and so it was, there were a lot of resistance. The advertising agencies, people were paid off by other production companies.